Now, the writer Miranda Richmond Muyot is also a translator. Her grandfather was one of the simultaneous translators at the Nuremberg trials, an experience that she says damaged him forever, as he had to channel those awful experiences right through his own body as a sort of witness. She wrote about that in her book, A 50-Year Silence. But here she is talking about the books that shaped her, and she makes sure to name the translators as well as the writers, you'll notice.
My theme is falling in love, that little electric bolt you feel that, and I don't mean falling in love with a person, I mean falling in love with an idea or work that makes you think, you can do this, I can do this. And I think that's the basis of creativity in art, is seeing that in other people and thinking, if you can do this, then I can do that. I love that moment. So I went and looked for those moments. And the epigraph of my book, I was going to read it because it's about that moment and how it changes you. And it's by one of my favorite authors. His name is Sándor Márai. He's a Hungarian author who was in exile in France. And it's translated by Carol Brown Janeway. And he says, "What do you think? Do you also believe that what gives our lives their meaning is the passion that suddenly invades us, heart, soul, and body, and burns in us forever, no matter what else happens in our lives?" And I have quite a few of those passions. The first one is Carmina Burana. I heard Carmina Burana for the first time when I was about 5. My father took me to see a live performance of it, and I was just electrified. It reverberated through my body. And I remember in particular the gong. The gong. I'm a very synesthetic person, and I just remember this blue and gold and green explosion that was set off in my mind and filled the concert hall. And I actually got to go up and meet the man with the gong afterwards, and it was probably the highlight of my young existence. My second is the painter, Vasily Kandinsky, who was a synesthete. And there's actually some debate about whether he was putting it on, which I find very comical, because if you are a synesthete, everything you see, in my case and in Kandinsky's case, is color. And when I first saw one of his paintings, it was another moment in my life where I thought, you can do that. Because he did. And people said all kinds of crotchety things. People get very crotchety about synesthesia. Apparently John Locke was the first person to get crotchety about synesthesia. In 1609, he said, I've met this studious blind man who claims that when he hears a trumpet, he feels the color scarlet. And people get very crotchety about that, but I don't. I am electrified by Kandinsky and then all of the other painters who kind of got on that, who said, you can do that, and began painting what they felt. And I like to paint for myself, but I also think of my writing as this sort of torturous sometimes attempt to get all that color that I'm feeling on paper. My third is someone whose name I will most likely butcher. He's a Japanese textile artist named Ichiko Kubota. And I almost had another life. I almost had several other lives, but one of the lives I almost had was of becoming a textile artist. I apprenticed to a weaver named Ruth Gaines when I was 13, and I did that all through my secondary school years. And I discovered this kimono artist, this Japanese kimono artist, who walked into a museum and had one of those electrifying moments. He said he saw a little bit of fabric in a museum, and he said, "My heart was beating faster. I was moved, trembling in the face of such mastery and refinement of beauty." And apparently he stood and stared at this thing for 3 hours, and then he spent the rest of his life trying to revive the techniques that he had seen in this piece of cloth. And he had all kinds of adventures. He was sent off to war. He was Japanese, so he ended up in a Siberian detention camp, I think. And he just spent his life first reviving the traditional technique, and then somewhere along the road of his life, he said, "Oh, I can do this." And he made his own technique, and he made these spectacular, mind-bendingly beautiful kimonos, which if you ever have a chance to see, you can see some of them on the internet, and they're really worth getting lost in for 3 hours. So my number four is a historiographer, a French historiographer named Michel de Certeau, who, as French historiographers are a bit difficult to read. And I discovered him when I was at university and had probably the hardest, I can do this moment. He doesn't write history. He writes about writing history. And he writes about other things as well. But he has this book called The Writing of History. And in it, he sort of takes apart your little historian mind. At least he took apart my little historian mind when I was studying history. And he pointed his finger at the vertigo you feel when you're doing historical research, and you have this mass of facts, and you know that it's only the tip of an iceberg of a mass of facts that you will never be able to recover but exist. And when you're writing, you must somehow acknowledge the existence of these facts and at the same time carve something out of the iceberg that you can communicate to another human being. And de Certeau writes about that sometimes really bafflingly. But he writes, the thing I like the best about his writing is he writes about the way you must draw the line between what really happened, which, as you know, if you're alive, is an endless stream of facts and feelings and events. And to write history, you must take the terrible step of drawing a line that pushes all of those significant details away so that you can actually draw out a history that a human mind can understand. And I think that was the "you can do this" moment where I thought, I may never be an academic because I don't like writing history that way, but I must learn to write that way.
Writer and translator Miranda Richman Muyot with her writerly and other influences. This is Books Plus on RN, and I'm Kate Evans.